Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, November 8th, 2013, 4:08, and it's the Federal News Countdown every Friday in the 4 o'clock hour. The three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. This week, my experts are Tim Young from Deloitte. It's good to see you, my friend. It's been a while since you've been on the Countdown show.
Yeah, it's been about a year.
So I apologize for that.
You didn't like me anymore.
Well, now how could you ever assume that? I mean, why would someone not like you?
I don't know.
But you're here, and I'm very happy that you're here. Three great selections for the Countdown this week, and it's good to see you. And my other expert, Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council. And I have to say, congratulations on the GovCon Awards last night. You and your colleagues at the Fairfax Chamber did a fantastic job, as always.
It's a great night.
Had a terrific time, and I hit the lottery ticket because I was sitting with one of your winners, right. Kim McCabe of ASI Government, happened to be my host last night, hostess. And so I was fortunate enough to be able to celebrate with her.
It's like
and her
being
team.
At the Oscars, right, when she gets the name now?
Yeah, that's right. And she didn't have any idea it was going to be her, and she got up there and recognized her folks. It was terrific. So it's great to have you here as well.
Thanks, Francis.
We start where we always start on the Federal News Countdown. That's with...
Number three!
And, Tim, your third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Veterans Hiring Reaches 20-Year High in 2012. And while the numbers are really good, my sense as I read this story was they should be, because this is certainly something that every agency in the administration as a whole has just hammered on since they've come into office.
Yeah, true kudos for the administration to pull this through. The article talks about the government had hired a higher percentage of veterans in fiscal 12. More than it has in the past two decades, and that was a recent report from the Office of Personnel Management. And the reason I think that this is such a great government news story, both for the federal government as well as our veterans who've served in a military capacity and are looking to transfer over to a civilian capacity, is that Monday is actually Veterans Day, right? So the timing is great on that. And this news story is actually near and dear to my heart for two primary reasons. Number one, my wife, who, Francis, you know,
yes,
who just happens to obviously be very phenomenal, right? By the way,
just by the very nature of the fact that she's your wife.
Well, that plus she's obviously visually impaired as well. she was a former military army captain and is now a civilian nurse, a cardiology nurse at Walter Reed National Military Medical Hospital, and so you know, the fact that Michelle, my wife, did this and transitioned from active duty military to civilian, I think, is compelling. And obviously, additional veterans are following suit. Number two, the reason why I think this is relevant to federal and personal to me is because this past year I had an opportunity to volunteer some time to the Wounded Warriors at Walter Reed on how to train and coach them on how to transition from military to the private sector, not necessarily military to government. It was part of a volunteer effort called Impact Day, which is sponsored by Deloitte, where we take all of our practitioners on a once a year, and we take them away from clients, and we put them in front of a philanthropic cause of their choosing, about 800 volunteer sites across the country. What I did with the Wounded Warriors that day was taught them how to develop a compelling resume, taught them how to transfer their military service into relevant interview points, develop interview skills, et cetera. You know, admittedly, I think I got more out of the experience than they did, but it was a very moving experience for me.
That description transfer is what everybody that I've talked to in DOD, in VA, in the Labor Department, everybody says is the really critical point, too, is these men and women come out of the service with amazing skills that employers really want, but they don't have the best ability yet to describe how what they can do can add value to a civilian organization.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I've certainly found that many of them had demonstrated leadership in many different capacities, but were challenged in how they were going to characterize that on a resume and how they were going to conduct a professional interview. So it's a very moving experience, and Deloitte as a firm takes pride in the fact that we hire a large number of veterans on an annual basis, some of which are Wounded Warriors.
Soloway, you can't resist, can you?
No, I was going to add something to this. First of all, kudos to Deloitte for their Impact Day generally, because I've been involved in a lot of the pro bono movement nationally, and Deloitte's one of the leaders in that. But the next step in the veterans program is something that we're working on with the Northern Virginia Technology Council, which is how do you translate veteran experience in the military to federal job descriptions so that a government contractor can actually hire them and validate that they're qualified. This is actually, there are some legal issues there in how you do it. Senator Warner, Senator Kaine, others are involved. So that's the next step in this process so that we can help them transition.
Tim Young's third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Veterans Hiring Reaches 20-Year High in 2012. Stan, your third most important story of the week is from FCW. The headline is Data Act IT Consolidation Bill Advance in the Senate. This is something that the Data Act in particular, the Digital Accountability and Transparency Act, this has been kicking around for a while. It's taken a number of different forms. Is this the one that you think is going to make it through, and is that necessarily a good idea?
Yes and yes. And that's why I picked the story, is principally around the Data Act piece, although the IT consolidation is more of an aside in this.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, it's been kicking around for a couple of years, several years now. There was a House bill and a Senate bill with very different approaches. And basically, the design here is to get much better data, as the title would suggest, around government spending and around these issues that we always have of how much is our agency spending on X, Y, and Z and so forth. The Senate bill, which we found much preferable to the House bill, and no disrespect intended to the House authors, basically said it's our job as the government to track our spending. The House bill said, okay, we're going to track our spending, but anybody we pay anything to is going to report back to us through a third system and create this great system in the sky where, as the payee or the receiver, you will report back to us what we paid you,
mm-hmm.
and that'll be our database. Well, one, and Tim knows this better than most, you'll find that database and federal procurement data system will not nothing alike.
Mm-hmm.
But the bigger piece was that the so-called accountability piece here, and it'd be very delicate because I don't want to sound like we're against accountability. The House bill actually would have given the inspectors general all kinds of subpoena authority to validate that the information was correct. Companies, when they submitted the information, it would be considered a legal submission, what we call a certified submission, which means it's subject to the False Statements Act.
So if they made a mistake,
if they
even
made a
if
mistake,
it was an honest
you could
mistake,
be in
they're
substantial
out of
trouble,
mm-hmm.
immediately into a sort of a criminal level review. When they have no incentive to make a mistake, I mean, they have to declare what they got. But the question became, why would you do this? Why would you create this incredibly expensive and potentially confusing second system when the answer should be, how do we improve government systems to track what the government spending, just like you or I or any other business would do? And Senator Warner understood that, and I think he came up with a smarter sort of way to cut at this and get at the core, which is really getting visibility into the spending. Accountability, we have a million ways to get accountability. We don't have very many ways to get really good tracking on the spending.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Stan Soloways from FCW. The headline, Data Act and IT Consolidation Bill Advance in the Senate. And you can find links to that and all the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important stories of the week as selected by Stan Soloway and Tim Young on the Federal News Countdown. We'll be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Stan Soloway and by Tim Young. We're up to
number two.
And Tim, your second most important federal news story of the week is headlined TSA Expands Expedited Screening at BWI. They are now opening a new pre-check lane at on the Concourse C checkpoint. You can get to all three concourses, A, B, and C, through this. But what's the significance of this in your mind, Tim?
Yeah, so the significance of this story is not really what I want to talk about. The story talks about this opening up at BWI Airport, which is nice. What I wanted to talk about was really the broader relevance of the program, the pre-check program. It allows selected frequent flyers of participating airlines and members of the CBP Trusted Traveler Program who are flying participating airlines to receive expedited screening through the security checkpoints. Eligible participants use dedicated screening lanes that you may have seen at surrounding airports or at other airports outside of D.C. To expedite the screening process, where you don't have to, you can leave on your shoes, your outerwear belts, you can leave your laptops and your liquids in your carry-on bag. So to date, I think the statistic is 19 million passengers have experienced pre-check through the program since it launched in October 2011. The reason I picked this as significant is because it has national scale. It impacts the entire flying public. And it, in my view, it demonstrates citizen-centric government, right, and some innovation that was applied here. with some smart people at TSA around how you transform from a one-size-all-fits approach to a risk-based security approach to collaborate with industry and have an improved partnership with the airlines. This takes into account the various touch points of what represents, you know, 20 layers of security from TSA, and they're now integrating a lot of those layers. There's an estimate that they're going to roll this out to 100 airports this year. And so for anyone who doesn't want to stand in a long line at the airport for security purposes, you may want to consider this program. The benefits of this approach, I think, include increasing the flow of commerce within the domestic economy, decreasing the burden to the traveling public, obviously less time in the line is more time you can spend at Starbucks or Chick-fil-A in the airport. And then lastly, improving relationships and partnerships with the airlines and potentially, and I say potentially, reducing security-related costs of airports. And so for those reasons, the fact that it's good for government, it's good for the airports, it's good for the citizens, that's why I picked this one.
If we're 8 to 10 years into a consciousness on security issues in airline flying, Stan, is that a good number? Has this taken too long to get to this, or are we doing this more quickly than one would expect, or what's the context here, I guess, in getting to a solution like this, which is, as Tim says, very citizen-focused and customer-facing?
Well, it's interesting that Tim picks this as second story, because my second story gets into performance management, and I would directly relate this to the same question, and it's part of the point I want to make about performance management. But to answer your question, I don't know if it's the right time or not. I mean, this was all new, and nothing new, nothing to ease off in security was going to happen for a certain period of time. I think that Tim's right that this is an example of citizen-centric, but it's also an example not only of innovation, but of also using data. I mean, recognizing what the real threats are, how you can identify threats in advance. And thus, quote, pre-clear people, if you will. I'm going to jump ahead, if I can, to my number two story, because it's directly related to the next generation of federal performance management.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I chose it is because it's fascinating to me that at this era when we've had shutdowns and furloughs and all this budget craziness out there, that agencies really still have their head down trying to develop performance measures that actually matter. That's the good news. The bad news is that, A, the environment makes it almost impossible to achieve any real performance measures because what can you plan against?
If you're not performing, then it doesn't matter what the measures are.
You can set any goal you want, but if the surrounding environment makes it impossible to get there, you're not going to get to the goal.
Right.
And then the other piece is there's still a lot of performance measurement in government that's very high level. One of the hardest things to do in government is to relate high-level mission requirements as you would in a company or in a university or anyplace else to what everybody in the organization does, align it in a way where you can actually measure performance and align performance. So what I sometimes find more exciting, as much as I appreciate the story that John Kaminsky had, the article he had in Government Executive about the progress we're making on performance management and the work that's been done since Jeff Zients and Shelley Metzenbaum really kind of pushed this to the next level, is that sometimes I think it's better to step back and look at slices of where we can take information, take data, take inputs, take innovation, and actually make what are not insignificant changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, as Tim said, if you can cut down somebody's wait time in an airport from 40 minutes in a line to 5 minutes or 4 minutes, that's meaningful. Mm-hmm. It has all kinds of value, intrinsic and otherwise. And so my purpose for picking the performance management story was to remind people that a lot of this is still going on. People's heads are down. They're really trying to do it. The system is making it nearly impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, you've got other examples, and I think the TSA one is a great one of where they're actually going to be able to drive real performance, measurable value here, with a relatively modest initiative. It's not a big, costly thing.
And that system not performing correctly was what I was implying about the lack of performance. Not that the agencies aren't performing appropriately. It's just that when you're closed, it's really hard
to perform at all. Oh, yeah, no, I know what you mean. Yeah, I agree.
And Stan's comments about performance management are exactly what I was getting at with the question about whether 8 to 10 years is sufficient. Because, yes, this is all new, and, yes, we've never done anything like this before. And inevitably, something else will come along that's all new that we've never done before, and I would think it would be instructive to understand how did we do with the information that we had in this case, even if it was a long-term case and not a quick 6 month or 1 year or 2 year program.
Yeah, I mean, so ultimately, to Stan's point, what really matters here is the result, right? Mm-hmm. How many airports have deployed this? How many of the traveling public are adopting it? How fast are they getting through? Are any, you know, bad guys getting through that shouldn't get through this process? And the evidence suggests no to the last point. There's actually a great quote in the article I wanted to draw out. It talks about Department of Housing and Urban Development set a goal on increasing the number of families housed rather than focusing on reducing the number of vacant public housing units. This led to improved housing outcomes, and I think that's the word of focus here is not an output, not a report, not a system, but an outcome. An outcome is something that's based on reality that helps an individual, in this case, assisted housing residents. And what I learned, and I learned a lot of things from OMB, some good and actually some bad, but one of the things I learned, though, is that measurement only doesn't yield an outcome. Right. Measurement leads to something of value or some problem being managed. And the management is what which yields you the outcome. And we had a very simple equation when we designed USAspending.gov under the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act that then-Senator Obama, now President Obama, endorsed, which was transparency provides you clarity to your challenges. And clarity of your challenges provides for personal accountability, to actually exact personal accountability. And only through personal accountability can you receive enduring results. And I think, you know, this story and I think why Stan is talking about this is really important to individuals. Even if you've never worked in the federal government before, you're paying a lot of money for your taxpayers, and you should expect these types of outcomes from your federal government. So I actually love this story, and I love the focus of it, that performance management is not just a nice to have, it's a necessary.
Stan's second most important federal news story of the week's from GovExec. The headline is The Trends Defining Federal Performance Management in 2014.
Yeah, I just want to add one last thing on this, because I think that as you think through sort of the continuum of what's going on, one of the benefits, I led the strategic planning effort for a federal agency just the last couple of years. I was on the board of a federal agency, and I led the strategic planning there. One of the interesting things about where we've gone with performance management, and I think this, and Tim probably could speak to this better than I, but if you look at the initial Government Performance Results Act, the renewal in 2010, and sort of the focus that Jeff Zients and Shelley Metzenbaum and others have put and how they put it on these outcomes, it also forces you as the operational entity, the government or whomever is involved, to be willing, and you have to open your aperture. You can't design performance goals that only meet your preconceived notions or the way you know how to do something or whatever. But if I start really measuring you against the art of the possible, I mean, I don't care how many, you know, empty houses there are. I really care how many people we have housed. That puts you actually on a different path, and it actually is an absolutely essential element to driving innovation, because otherwise I can set performance goals that are actually look really good but don't actually mean much.
The idea of that, though, getting to that, is what you worked on to some degree at OMB. Your colleague Robert Shea was instrumental in driving that in the Bush administration. And as Stan said, Shelley and Jeff have continued that in this administration. Now we have a new team there to continue that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the single best management framework that I had during my 5.5-year tenure at OMB within the White House was the President's Management Agenda Scorecard, right? It was simple, and that's why it was elegant and I think effective. It was red, yellow, green relative to goals and relative to quantitative measures.
Mm-hmm.
So on a quarterly basis, you knew what the goal was and you knew how you were going to be measured. End of the quarter, you were measured. You got a red, yellow, green. And we met with the president, you know, once or twice a year with the entire President's Management Council, which are the deputy secretaries, to present the status of all the agencies and where they stood on the President's Management Agenda Scorecard. And in the first meeting, it became very apparent that there was a seating arrangement. That wasn't me. That wasn't Robert. That wasn't Karen. The seating arrangement was based on where the deputy secretaries of those agencies were on the scorecard.
Hmm.
The president sat in the middle. It was a semicircle conference room in the president's conference room in the old executive office building. The agencies sitting next to him were green. The agencies sitting in the middle were yellow. And at the very tail end of the table were the red agencies. And performance started to change, and attitudes changed dramatically that next day. Right, because the president said, when we come back again in 6 months or 9 months, I want to make sure you guys understand, those of you that are red on the scorecard will not be in my administration anymore. And that's very powerful.
And I think the one thing that we're watching right now, and I think it's important for all of us too, is we're a year into the second term, and we don't have the second term management agenda done. And, mm-hmm. and I think that there's some concern that you could launch a whole new management agenda today, don't have enough time to do it.
No, you've lost a year because you really only have 2 years.
And it's, this is not, again, not a criticism of the new director or the new deputy director. It's the system.
Mm-hmm.
But what Tim's talking to is a process that began day one. It was building off a process that was in place. We've had a gap for a while of really this focus with Jeff and Shelley leaving and now Beth and Sylvia Burwell coming on. So I think timing is going to become really critical to make management matter in the next 2 years, because it's about all we have left of this particular administration.
The second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Stan Soloway. It's a GovExec story headlined "The Trends Defining Federal Performance Management in 2014 by our friend John Kaminsky. And Tim's choice, Tim Young, for the second most important story of the week, TSA expands expedited screening at BWI. All the stories on the countdown are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Tim Young and Stan Soloway on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Tim Young of Deloitte. And we're up to
number one.
Tim Young's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is the headline, "Obama meets with U.S. leaders on NIST's draft cybersecurity framework." And depending which accounts of this you read, you've selected one by Alexei Alexis, but depending which account of this you read, Tim, this could be admonition. This could sound like arm twisting. It could sound like any number of different approaches that the president took, depending on who heard what.
Yeah. Well, one thing I want to say is, as we're approaching the end of the interview, it is obvious that there's you definitely have a voice for radio. And looking around, Stan and I have the face for radio. Right?
That's very kind.
Speak for yourself.
Okay. And funny, by the way. So.
So the reason I picked this one is because cyber and infrastructure protection it's not a federal-wide challenge. It's not an agency-specific challenge. It's a national challenge, and it impacts every critical infrastructure of the government, which is predominantly owned by the commercial sector, right? And so this is a prime example of national leadership by partnering with the private sector. I mean, that when you look into the article, it talks about releasing an early version of the cybersecurity framework by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, but President Obama met with the CEOs of the infrastructure protection owners. In this case, it was finance, IT, and energy sectors, to drive them to the point that this is a true partnership. The significance of this program, frankly, is that if we don't get national and cybersecurity right, and we don't get infrastructure protection right, nothing else really matters. I mean, if bad guys can hack into our networks and have, you know, gigabytes or terabytes of exfiltration of sensitive or nationally secure data, or actually the intellectual property of companies, if they can steal that information, or they can take down the energy grid or the electrical grid, the rest of what we do around federal protection of assets, logical and physical assets, doesn't really matter. And so, yeah, I just wanted to highlight the awareness of this. This is certainly, in my view, not only a national challenge. This is probably a generational challenge. This is not something that can be solved in the next couple of years. And I applaud a lot of the people at DHS's NPPD Directorate for working with NIST and working with others, including OMB, to try to get this right on a national scale.
I might maybe even take it one step further and wonder if it's something that will be solved, not just in this generation, or if it's something that, as the threat landscape continues to evolve, the response and the preparation will have to continue to evolve. And just the fact, maybe we can consider it a success if we continue to stay on top of it and continue to be engaged at the level that we're engaged now. Is that?
It's a great point. I mean, obviously, the more interconnected we've become as an economy, as a global economy, the more vulnerable we are, right? Instead of focusing on no risk, mm-hmm. and locking everything down, I think the administration is appropriately focusing on a risk-based framework, so that you don't, for example, try to bring in, to use a figure of speech, bring in a backhoe to remove a dandelion, mm-hmm. right? Not every threat is created equally, and not the origin of every threat is equally as powerful. And so I think this is a step in the right direction. I mean, certainly, The administration can't do it. The federal government can't solve this challenge without the private sector. And frankly, the private sector can't become secure with its infrastructure without the force and the push and potentially the regulation of the federal government.
Stan, Tim makes a really good point, I think, about the concept of getting national and cybersecurity right. But I think there are a lot of people that would make a very good case that we're still not quite to the point of even necessarily having them integrated yet.
Well, that was part of what I was going to say. I think part of the challenge here, and then the president's meeting this, you could say it was symbolic or not, with the business leaders and the message, the clarion call, you will, that they're sort of issuing and have repeatedly issued. But we still don't have an organizational, politically organized structure to manage this. We have tremendous turf battles over who's in charge of what. Again, I'm not taking a position on who's right or who's wrong. It's a fact that those battles exist. And so we're kind of all over the place. The other point I'd make is that, is to Tim's comment, and I think the challenge NIST has, and the NPPD over at Homeland Security, I think, is also in this, is how do you build a strategy that enables the government to capitalize on the best of practices in the commercial world and then apply them also to how they do business. And the point is that the government, in many cases, you know, we want certain technology, but the way we buy that technology is very different than the way anybody else buys that technology. Well, mm-hmm. we can't approach cyber like that. And so as we look at things like the executive order, we look at the NIST standards and so forth, it's a question of how do you meld them? Because this is not new. I mean, it's getting worse. You're absolutely right. It's a layering, and then we'll get past one stage, and then it's like an antibiotic-resistant flu. You're going to continue have to be develop new antidotes as you go along. Even when I was in the Pentagon in the 90s, we were already starting to have what we would term today cyber attacks and cyber issues in Kosovo and elsewhere. So we learned how to deal with that. We go to the next generation. But coming back to the point, till we get an organizational structure around it and have a pretty clear path towards unifying the strategy, not segmenting it, I think there could be some challenges.
And this is going to be a two-track thing, too. One track is going to be the defense and the triage of intrusions, and the other track is going to be building this framework to prevent them from happening in the future. And those tracks sometimes will be in front of the other, but it strikes me that they'll probably always be pretty close to each other. Is that fair to say, do you think?
Yeah, and I think there's a third track that has been published. This is not national security sensitive information, that there's the defensive side, there's the framework, but there's also the offensive side.
Mm-hmm.
When certain nation states or individual players come after our networks and our national security data, you know, in certain cases we go on the offense to make sure that they are no longer in a position to do that. Excuse me. So I think the combination of all those points into what Stan was saying earlier, this is a prime example of where we have to have a bipartisan priority here. This is not a Democratic priority. This is not a Republican priority. This is where the administration, the future administration, the Congress needs to get in step and in line with the commercial sector so that we can focus, in this case, on getting it right versus focusing on being right.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually want to pick up, Tim made a comment on the – with regard to his second story, actually, the TSA story about bad guys getting through, that nothing's going to be perfect. The other piece here that's going to be critical, and this is purely a business risk issue, is how do we manage the liabilities here?
Mm.
Who's going to have what responsibilities and what liabilities? And I can't say to Tim as Deloitte, hey, your information says it's your problem. Anything happens, you're completely liable because you're betting the farm every time you turn on your computer. And not that companies shouldn't have enormous accountability for the quality of their cybersecurity program. But there's going to have to also be a very realistic conversation like we've done about many other things, from nuclear energy to other things, where there's some shared liability and shared responsibility, recognizing that stuff happens. And some of those things are unforeseeable. It can't be as simple as some of the early policy drafts were that said that companies are going to be entirely responsible. Well, mm-hmm. a lot of companies aren't in the software business, they're not in the technology business. So I think there's a liability, a business liability. How we manage all those risks together is still an open question.
It strikes me that that's doable, Stan, that a company could take on all that risk, but God only knows what it would cost for them to be able to do that. There's no insurance system in place.
You couldn't take it on. And I think I just want to say that I don't want to suggest that this is a contentious issue, because at this point, from where I sit, it seems to be everybody gets that.
Right.
It's getting to an answer to it. It's not like, oh, no, we won't want to go there. Tim's much more involved in that.
And frankly, if a company was being asked to accept 100% of the liability, let's say they're a publicly traded company, they're going to pass it on to their shareholders anyway.
Right.
Right. And so that's going to negatively impact the economy. And so I think to Stan's point, some sound reasoning needs to go into the balance between accountability and responsibility and liability.
The second, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Tim Young of Deloitte, is the Bloomberg BNA story, Obama meets with U.S. business leaders on NIST's draft cybersecurity framework. And you can find it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Stan Soloway's choice for the most important federal news story of the week wraps up this week's Federal News Countdown next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Tim Young of Deloitte and Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council. And Stan, your most important federal news story of the week is from Bloomberg BNA. The headline is Senator Mikulski renews calls for top-line deal to craft omnibus. She, of course, is the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and this is her job to ask for this number. But what has struck me about this conversation, and not just this, but a letter that she wrote in conjunction with Congressman Mike Rogers, the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, is that they're asking for a top-line number, but they're not asking for a particular top-line number. They're just saying, just give us one, give us a number so that we can move forward.
Yeah,
is that unusual, do you think? Does that strike you as odd? Or
you know, the whole thing is odd.
Well, okay. All right, fair enough.
There's no normal here. You've touched on part of what struck me about the story and sort of what's going on right now. I happen not to believe that we're going to see another shutdown. I think both parties have agreed they don't want to go through that.
Yeah.
And so I'm at this point more optimistic than I was, say, in August, whether we'd have a shutdown in October. I think we're probably not going to have one. To your point, though, there was Hal Rogers and Barbara Mikulski sending a letter saying, give us a top line. They also said in their letter, and they've said publicly, that they've already identified areas for savings. And I looked at that, and my optimistic side says, wow, they're really talking, they're really getting close, and maybe we will have, it's not going to be a big deal, but at least for the year. But then I step back and say, we still have a reality, and the reality is the House marked to a sequestered level of $967 billion for the government. The Senate is over $1 trillion, according to the Budget Control Act levels and so forth. So there's a pretty big gap. I actually find it very hard to believe that either of them thinks that they have a number between them that they could sell to their own caucus. Second is the top line is just the beginning. If I were looking at the budget projections, and there are six different scenarios you can paint right now that are out there. You have House and Senate bills, you get sequester without sequester, so on, President's bill. Just assume for a moment that the House Republican number, the top line number at $967 billion, is the number, because it's probably not going to go much higher than that. I don't think that my gut instinct is they're not going to get much more than that through the House. But beneath that, there's no agreement how to spend the money.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a House budget that is much heavier on defense than the Senate budget, and obviously, therefore, less spending for the non-defense agencies and the reverse in the Senate. So here we are, November. What is today's date?
November 8th.
8th, thank you. So we're about 5 weeks from the so-called deadline. They're going to be taking at least a couple of weeks off from Thanksgiving and through there, so we've really got a couple of weeks left, maybe 6 or 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then not much time between that. You've got the holidays, and then we roll up to the end of the CR. We don't yet even have an agreement on a top line. How are we going to get to the below the top line distribution of dollars? And so I look at this as, on the one hand, hopeful that they're that at least the language is a little bit different, that they're writing a letter together and so forth. But they got a lot of work to do in a really short period of time. As I said, I don't think we're going to shut down. I think if this a week from now, we haven't seen much more progress, we could be looking at another 30-day, another 45-day CR, or whatever it might be, get us through the debt and keep fighting this. Meanwhile, federal agencies, you want to talk about performance, you want to talk about innovation, they're going to be hanging out there waiting.
Yep.
Because there's nothing you can do.
That stuff just has to stay on hold, Tim. And the disparity that Stan is talking about is particularly difficult on the DOD side, because I'm looking here at some notes that say the final BCA cap for fiscal 14 for DOD is $475 billion. Senator Reid is about to bring up either this week or next, well, it'll have to be next week now, the National Defense Authorization Act that's marked at $526 billion in the main part of the budget and $79 billion for OCO. So the disparity there to me seems to be even bigger in defense than the non-defense side.
Yeah, this is a bad situation. I think, in my view, this is what's wrong with Washington, right? When you have, you know, an observation because of gerrymandering of congressional districts, right? You have far right and far left candidates that can hold on to their jobs year over year, election through election, because they win with a vast majority of the electorate. Secondly, you have super PACs that influence congressional elections, and they used to not be that powerful. And then lastly, in order to win in a primary, a congressman or senator has to flank their incumbent on the far right or the far left, which creates this chasm, if you will, and creates, in my view, bad policy. In this case, bad fiscal policy, where they're not focusing on compromise. They're not focusing on, you know, drawing a line in the middle and finding common ground and thinking of their electorate, their constituents, and the federal workforce, for example. Instead, they're focusing, to my earlier point, focusing on being right versus getting it right. I'm not sure how this sorts itself out. I just know that my view is that this political system is not extensible. This is not something that can continue year over year, administration over administration. Like, at some point, something needs to break and someone needs to compromise. The outcome here, frankly, I think, to Stan's point, I don't think they'll shut down the government again. I hope they don't, right? I know I have some clients who hope they don't shut it down. But I think it's going to be a last-minute deal, as it was in the last case, and I just think cooler heads need to prevail here.
I think the other piece here, though, is to step back and realize two things that have struck me about the debate over the last several months. One, and Francis, we may have talked about this before, that a year ago, or over a year ago, say a year ago spring, early stages of the end of the primary season, it was an article of faith on both parties that I have to come up with a deficit reduction plan. And my plan is better than yours on deficit reduction, or my plan is better on debt. I mean, they were both acknowledging that.
Mm-hmm.
That agreement no longer exists. One could make an argument that the lower federal deficit today doesn't mean that the long-term picture is all that much rosier. Forget the substance of it. You do have the reemergence of a school of thought that says, hey, the deficit's not really as big a problem as we thought. We can go back to an investment strategy. So you have a philosophical debate reemerging that wasn't there. Second, I think it's interesting to pay attention to the hearings that were held yesterday, when the chairman and all the service chiefs testified in the Senate, and Senator McCain and others were expressing very serious skepticism about whether DOD, and I'm not taking a position, I'm trying to paraphrase the way they put it, it was almost like you're Chicken Little, that you haven't got your own house in order, that there's massive savings to be had through a variety of steps that you haven't yet taken. Whether he's right or wrong, and there were others, he wasn't the only one who had taken this view, that tension is emerging, is pretty heavy. So that it's not even a DOD is, you can talk about readiness levels, but there's other things you DOD can do. So how that plays out, and it's awful late. I mean, we're here in November. You would have thought this was a debate we would have had, obviously, months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have some core debates, and Tim's correct on the sort of the big political picture, but you've got these sort of core level debate issues that have kind of reemerged, and it's not clear where they head.
Mm. What, with that lack of clarity, Tim, that makes it extremely difficult for our friends in the executive branch agencies to figure out anything, let alone what the next half of this year will look like or try to figure out 2015.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers alone dictate that something structural has to change in Congress in terms of how they deal with the fiscal environment. Roughly two-thirds of the federal budget is what's called mandatory. That's Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. That's the mandatory spending that has to occur. Unless there's a change in law. Almost a third is discretionary, right? And that number shrinks every year, right? Actually, I think it's three quarters, almost one quarter. The balance is interest on the debt that has to be paid on an annual basis. So every year that Congress and a administration, I'm not going to just put this on the Obama administration, but a administration does not change the way in which our outlays of funding for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, as long as that continues, every year discretionary has to shrink unless taxes raise, right? So there's going to be a point, primarily on the civilian side of government, to a lesser extent on DOD, at which discretionary shrinks to a point at which we have to cut significant cuts in workforce, the federal workforce, and programs, right? And that's the point, I think, at which the electorate and constituents will say, hold on a second, we actually need that program. That supports me. It gives me, you know, it pays my heating bill, or mm-hmm. that helps put food on the table, or whatever the issue is. Until we get to that point, though, I don't see a situation in which leaders in Congress will say, hey, let's reform entitlements, right? I think this is only my personal view. I think it's going to take a two-term president of one party that has a filibuster-proof majority in both chambers of Congress.
The only one other thing I'd add is a quasi-bright side to all this. It's not if if you accept the premise that part of the game here is just having some clarity and predictability, whether you're a federal agency, just like a company, you want to know where the market's going, at least on the civilian side, they have a relatively good sense of what their top line is likely to look like. For them, it's more an issue of length of funding. If I get a 60-day or 30-day or 90-day CR, there's very limited things I can do. If you tell me I'm going to fund you for the rest of the year, even though it's at current levels, I kind of know where I am. Sequester doesn't have sort of the drama for most – it has a hit. I don't mean it's diminished in any way. But DOD takes 50% of it, and there's a lot more fungibility over there in terms of impact. And so what we saw last year at the civilian agencies is once they got over the fiscal cliff on December 31st, they actually got back to a relatively normalized process, even though they went through two more funding cycles with the sequester and then the CR at the end of March, because things didn't change radically for most civilian agencies. The shifts were more on the DOD side.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Stan Soloway, is headline, Senator Mikulski renews calls for top-line deal to craft omnibus. It is a Bloomberg BNA story that is linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, just like all the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown. Gentlemen, it's great to have you here. Tim Young of Deloitte, good to have you back on the show.
Likewise, thanks for having me.
Happy to do it. And Stan Soloway, the Professional Services Council, and congratulations again on a great GovCon last night.
Thanks, Francis. It's always great to be here.